So this talk tonight and discussion is about our second in the series looking at the Kalama Sutta, which is in the part of this book by Bhikkhu Bodhi called In the Buddha's Words. It's in the third chapter called Approaching the Dhamma. In other words, how do we come to the teachings? What kind of attitudes, what kind of preparation do we bring when we come to the Buddha's teachings? And just to review a little bit from last time, the Buddha was in a community called Kesaputta. There was a group of people there called the Kalamas, and their village was at the edge of a forest. And in those days, it was not safe to go through the forest at night, so many of the teachers and pilgrims would stop in their town as they're wandering around India. And as a result, they got a wide variety of teachings from many different teachers, which is great. The problem was not that teachers were just offering their teachings, but they would also disparage, debunk, revile, and vilify the doctrines of others. So pretty soon this became very confusing, because people would not only offer their own teachings, but they'd be slamming the other person's teachings and putting doubt in the mind. And as you probably know, doubt is one of the very insidious hindrances in that it completely eliminates our ability to practice. Because we not only doubt the teachings, but then we start doubting our own ability to, well, ultimately to awaken, but I mean, even to practice. We start doubting, well, is this the practice for me? And in this day and age when there are so many teachings available, we may experience something of the same kind of confusion, where there are so many teachings available, so many teachers, so many schools within schools within schools, that it may become a challenge for us to know what is right for us. What kind of teachings are the ones that challenge us to the point where we can actually make positive changes in our life, but also are easeful enough that we can stay with them? So this is the challenge that the Kalamas faced at that time, and it's the challenge that we face today. So that's why we started with this. Now, you'll remember from last time that Bhikkhu Bodhi said that faith is not needed to start on this path. So unlike some religions that require you to sign up to a certain dogmatic list at the beginning, it's not required to start on this path. At the same time, the Buddha told the Kalamas that when they hear teachings, they shouldn't rely on 10 sources of belief to decide what to believe and what they were hearing. 4 of these are based on scriptural authority, the fact that it's in a book, the fact that it's been around a long time, this sort of thing. 4 of them were based on rational approaches, which are pretty esoteric. They're different philosophical schools that were happening at the time of the Buddha, and there are probably more than 4, but things like logic, inference, that kind of thing. And then the last 2 were based on the qualities of the teacher. So, this person's my teacher, so what they're saying must be true, I should believe it. Well, don't. Don't believe it. And so he recommended that they test the teachings in their experience. And do you recall the litmus test that he used for testing in our experience? It's not just if it feels good, do it. You know, it was a little more direct than that, and it's also something that we've taught in here quite a bit. So anybody remember his definition of experience, what kinds of experience we should be using to test whether teachings are appropriate or not, whether we should follow them? The Buddha said, I teach one thing, suffering and the end of suffering, right? So that's the test. If following a certain teaching leads us toward confusion, dissatisfaction, discontent, in other words, suffering, then it's probably not an appropriate path. Whereas if something, and we're talking long term here, not, you know, you sit for 40 minutes and you get some discomfort in the body, that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about long term. And if the following of a certain body of teachings leads us to contentment, peace, treating others around us better, having compassion, any number of positive qualities that might develop as a result of the teachings, a lessening of discontentment, dissatisfaction, suffering, then that's a sign. That's the kind of experience that he's talking about that should be a clue to us that this particular body of teachings may be the one for us to follow. So that's what he meant about testing it in your own experience. Now, as we acknowledged last week, these 10, or not last week, but last time, these 10 things that he said not to use, oral tradition, the lineage of the teaching, hearsay, collection of texts, the fact that it comes from some highly revered collection of texts, and then the four philosophical ones are logic, inferential reasoning, reasoned cogitation, don't ask me the difference between that and the other two, acceptance of a view after pondering it, and then the two qualities of the teacher, the seeming competence of the teacher, and the thought that this person is our teacher. So those are the 10 things he said not to rely on. And I think we can hear in that list that, speaking for myself here, I use all of those all the time. But I think, so when I was thinking about this, I was thinking that what he's trying to say is don't use any of those on their own. Don't only use logic. I mean, I think no one's asking you to check your brain at the door when you walk into this hall. We actually expect you, when you're listening to a talk here, to evaluate if it makes sense at all. So I think when we listen to this teaching to not use these 10 things, we should understand that the Buddha is exhorting people not to only use those, but the primary way of testing these is to use your own experience, practice the teachings. The saying in Pali is ahipasako, come and see for yourself. And so to test it out in your own experience, and then, but don't rely on any of these others solely. Don't just think, well, this is in the Pali canon, therefore I have to believe it. You know, maybe that's a starting point, but then go beyond that and test it in your own experience. So I would caution against using too narrow of an interpretation of this very oft repeated text to not use any of these 10 things to evaluate a teaching. After thinking about this for a while, there you go. See, that's acceptance of a view after pondering it. After thinking about this for a while, and I did some teaching about this in Rockland as well, it's kind of occurred to me that actually these things in themselves aren't wrong or aren't, they are useful, but we shouldn't be depending on those alone. In other words, just because we think a teacher is competent doesn't mean we should accept everything he or she says instantly. We should be testing it in our own experience, and that should be the primary test. But please don't, you know, check your brains at the door. Please don't stop to use your own logic or your own cognitive abilities to look at a teaching and decide how it works for you in your own life. So does that all kind of make sense? Everybody feel like we're kind of on the same page? Anything else from last time that rings a bell or needs to be brought up? So that's the best known part of the Kalama Sutta. There are three more sections of it that I'd like to talk about tonight. And the first is that the Buddha asks, and this is actually a corollary of testing things in your own experience and deciding whether they lead to suffering or not. The Buddha asks them, the Kalamas, how greed, hatred, and delusion manifest. And he gives this list. If your thoughts are coming out of greed, hatred, and delusion, you're going to destroy life, you're going to take what is not given, You're going to engage in sexual misconduct, and you're going to tell lies. So does that list sound familiar to anybody? The first four of the precepts, right? The lay precepts. First four of the five. And they're often, for some reason, I don't know, Diane, if maybe you know why, often those four are given without the fifth one about ingesting intoxicants. So I'm not...
It was added later.
Oh, okay.
And from my very brief reading, it was an incident that took place in the Sangha, so he added it after these had been used for a while.
Okay. So a monk, perhaps, had been partaking in intoxicants and did something unskillful, and so that one was added. So, and then, as often as the formula in these suttas, the next section says, well, thoughts that come out of, that are not controlled by greed, hatred, and delusion manifest as abstaining from all of the above. So, as you know, the traditional way of repeating the precepts is to say, I resolve or I undertake the training to abstain from taking what is not freely given, to abstain from causing harm, to abstain from all of these things that result from thoughts rooted in greed, hatred, and delusion. And so when our thoughts are not controlled by these three roots, it manifests as knowing for yourself welfare and happiness, and prompting others to welfare and happiness. And then also in the way this is presented in the sutta, he also talks about when you're doing these unskillful things, you are prompting others to do those. So, you know, as we've said several times in here, often this practice feels sort of selfish or like we're just working on ourselves or staring at our navels or whatever. It's not that at all. It's a very social, engaged practice. And everything that we do prompts others to do that, whether we're consciously saying, you should do this, but actually, as many of you probably heard in the instruction for parenting, it's what you do much more than what you say that influences the messages that children pick up from a parent. Similarly, what he's saying here is that the skillful behaviors prompt others to act in the same way. Unskillful behaviors prompt others to act in the same way. So skillful behaviors lead to our own welfare and happiness, but as we prompt others to do that, we're also leading them toward welfare and happiness. And similarly, if we're doing unskillful behavior in our life, we're leading others to harm and suffering. So this is a very engaged practice, and we don't do any of this in a vacuum. The next section, and honestly, I've read the Kama Sutta a couple times before, and it never occurred to me that this teaching was inside this sutta, is that when you practice the precepts, when your thoughts are coming out of non-greed, non-hatred, and delusion, then the formula that's often used is devoid of covetousness, devoid of ill will, unconfused, clearly comprehending, and ever mindful. That almost sounds like language from the Satipatthana Sutta, right, about what happens when we practice mindfulness. Devoid of covetousness, devoid of ill will, unconfused, clearly comprehending, and ever mindful. What happens when we have those mind states? We dwell in the four Brahma Viharas. So actually the teaching of the Brahma Viharas is within this sutta. He is teaching these folks who have never been exposed to the Buddha's teaching the very first practice, the very second practice after the precepts that he's giving them are the Brahma Viharas. And as you've probably heard here as well, this is not the form of practicing the Brahma Viharas that's in the Vasuddhimagga, the later text that was written several hundred years after the Buddha, after the historical Buddha. This is the radiating outward form of practicing the Brahma Viharas that's taught by Anālayo and others today. So there's a formula for that as well. There aren't that many suttas where the Buddha actually teaches people. Often he'll describe what he did in this way, but this is one of the of not very many suttas that I've read that where the Buddha is actually teaching this as a practice to others. So he says, "Then Kalamas, that noble disciple, devoid of covetousness, devoid of ill will, unconfused, clearly comprehending, ever mindful, dwells pervading one quarter with a mind imbued with loving kindness. Likewise, the second quarter, the third, and the fourth. Thus, above, below, across, and everywhere, and to all as to himself, he dwells pervading the entire world with a mind imbued with loving kindness, vast, exalted, measureless, without hostility and without ill will." So we often use the word boundless to describe metta, loving kindness, boundless friendliness. This description is what boundlessness is all about. It's in all directions, the one quarter, two quarter, three quarter, four quarters, the four directions, same as the sacred directions of the many Native American nations. And then above, below, across, and then to others as well as to ourselves. So that's the kind of the scriptural seed that leads to the Vasuddhimagga later, spelling out that way of performing this practice. It spells out, well, if you're going to do others, how about trying this? Do a friend, a neutral person, a difficult person. You know, those are all spelled out in the Vasuddhimagga. But here he just says, and to all as to herself or himself. So I think that's really interesting that the Buddha would choose to teach this practice to people that have no grounding in the quote-unquote Buddhist teachings. You know, of course, the Buddha wasn't a Buddhist. But the Buddha was talking to a group of people that have been confused by numerous practices. And he's not just saying, in this Kalama Sutta, he's not just saying, oh, well, just listen to any teaching out there and test it in your own experience. Good luck. See you later. He's saying, okay, you're going to hear a lot of different things. Use your own experience. Use your own knowledge within your own heart of suffering and non-suffering to test these teachings. Don't just use logic. Don't just use the qualities of the teacher. Don't just use how exalted the teaching, the source material for the teaching is. Use your own experience. But also, let me offer the precepts. Let me offer the Brahma Viharas as a way of practicing that will settle your mind, that will specifically deal with confusion, right? They came to him. They said they were confused. And he said, you have every right to be confused. It is fitting for you to be perplexed, he said. It is fitting for you to be in doubt. He's acknowledging that, you know, you're going to hear all these teachings and teachers beating up on each other verbally, and it's no wonder that you're confused, but try these things out. And he specifically says, devoid of covetousness, devoid of ill will, unconfused, clearly comprehending, ever mindful. So he's offering the Brahma Viharas as a specific antidote for confusion. That's a nice lesson. And I don't know that I've ever seen it stated specifically like that in any other sutta. So that's worth knowing. We often hear about metta as being an antidote to ill will or to anger. Here he's offering all four Brahma Viharas as an antidote to confusion, to doubt. So as I mentioned before, sometimes doubt is really insidious and it causes us from being able to practice at all. We doubt our own ability to follow through on the practice. We doubt whether the practice that we're doing is really right for us. What he's saying is, even in that state of confusion, he's talking to a group of people that are confused, not just potentially. They actually are confused, and he's saying, try the Brahma Viharas. This might help you out in your state of confusion. So it might be a lesson for us in our own practice when we encounter periods of doubt, periods of confusion, which we inevitably will as we move forward in the practice, to remember this recommendation of practicing the Brahma Viharas to deal with that. And then he goes through all four of the Brahma Viharas. She dwells pervading one quarter with a mind imbued with compassion, with altruistic joy, what we sometimes call sympathetic joy, with equanimity, likewise the second quarter, the third, and the fourth. Thus above, below, across, and everywhere, and to all as to herself, she dwells pervading the entire world with a mind imbued with equanimity, vast, exalted, measureless, without hostility and without ill will. So that's the next section. And then the final section is what are called the four assurances. So despite the fact that these folks are in confusion, the Buddha assures them that they, if they practice in the way that he's recommending, if they practice, this is specifically linked to the Brahma Viharas, if they practice in this way, they have four assurances in this very life. Now, you remember last time that we talked about how Bhikkhu Bodhi is a fairly traditional Theravadin, he's a very traditional Theravadin teacher, orthodox. So he strongly believes in karma, rebirth, past and future lives. And so in the introduction to this section, he said, you know, just because he's telling these beginners not to take anything on faith doesn't mean that at some point in your practice there may be things that you can't verify in your personal experience, like karma, rebirth, future lives, past lives. So he believes in them, but he's saying you don't need to believe in those things to set out on the path, but it may be that at some point in your practice you're actually going to get to a place where those make sense to you. I can't speak to that yet from my personal experience, but I do know people that at some point in their practice have come to see that these things make sense for them. But at this point, to this audience, he's not talking to monks here. He's talking to lay people who are being exposed for the first time to his teachings. To this audience, he says, if you practice in this way, you will make your mind free of enmity, free of ill will, uncorrupted and pure, and you will win four assurances in this very life. So he's not telling them that they should even be aspiring at this point to some kind of higher rebirth or nibbana or anything like that. He's saying, in this very life, the first is this. If there is another world, and if good and bad deeds bear fruit and yield results, it is possible that with the break of the body after death, I shall arise in a good destination in a heavenly world. So that's karma and rebirth, right? If good and bad deeds bear fruit and yield results, that's karma. And then being reborn in a good destination is rebirth. Okay. So he's saying, if those things are true, and I practice this, I have an assurance that things are going to be turn out all right. The second assurance he has won is this. If there is no other world, and if good and bad deeds do not bear fruit and yield results, still, right here in this very life, I live happily, free of enmity and ill will. So this is the Buddha telling people that if karma and rebirth aren't real, and you have to remember, this is in a society, I mean, if they were Brahmin practitioners at that time, they believed in karma and rebirth already. Mm-hmm. He's telling that audience, if those don't exist, we're still going to live better in this life. We're still going to have a life that's free of enmity and ill will. Interesting. The third assurance is this. Suppose evil befalls the evildoer. Then, as I do not intend evil for anyone, how can suffering afflict me, one who does no evil deed? Comma, right? And the fourth assurance he has won is this. Suppose evil does not befall the evildoer. Then right here, I see myself purified in both respects. And the notes in the back say that when he says both respects, he's talking about I'm not creating any evil for myself, and evil won't befall me if karma is real. Okay. So I think even though Bhikkhu Bodhi cautions us against kind of throwing out the baby with the bathwater in his terms, you know, throwing out the orthodox Theravadan teachings because the Buddha is telling us to test things in our own experience and not rely on these other things. The tendency is just to throw all that out and say, well, I'm just going to cherry pick the teachings, and if I can't accept something right now, I'm just going to close my mind to it. I think what he's saying is keep an open mind to all of that, but you don't need to believe any of that to start your practice. I think that's a slightly different interpretation of the Kalama Sutta than we're often taught, but I think it's a useful one. This openness of mind is a really useful characteristic. Another word for it, I don't remember the Pali for it, but it is a form of humility that is ease of instruction. Someone is, they're able to learn because their minds are open to the teachings. They aren't arrogant and thinking that they know it all to begin with. And they're also amenable to instruction, I think is one of the translations. And again, I don't know the Pali word for this characteristic, but they're amenable to instruction. So if someone, for example, gives them a teaching, they're willing to hear it. If someone corrects their behavior, they're willing to actually look inside their own heart and acknowledge that, well, you know, maybe that behavior was needed to be corrected. I'm going to resolve to change my behavior. This openness of mind is a really useful characteristic to have in approaching the teachings, because we're going to hear things that we don't immediately grasp. The teachings are deep, they're profound. He taught for 40 years. My gosh, you know, they're, and he taught a wide variety of audiences. And so one should expect when we go to the teachings that if we're not particularly aligned with the audience as he's addressing, it would make sense that his message doesn't resonate with us. That shouldn't be taken as a sign that the Buddha's teachings were wrong or unskillful. It's just a sign that the way he was teaching that particular audience is not for us, because that's, you know, not directed to those of our temperament. You'll often see in the teachings reference to different kind of practices that work for people of different temperaments or different backgrounds. Today we might say different cultural competencies. So that's, I think, all I need to say about the Kalama Sutta. Any thoughts on any of that, or other thoughts that you had while reading either the text or Bhikkhu Bodhi's introduction? Because I was telling some folks earlier, I think the next time I talk, which is going to be in 3 weeks, I'll talk about the 5 spiritual faculties, which is going to be the topic of the day long. So chapter 10, I'll assign the reading once I get that together, but it's going to be on chapter 10. That's where the 5 spiritual faculties are found. So I think tonight will be the last time with the Kalama Sutta, unless something else comes up later. So anything in that that seemed new or surprising, or we've heard it all before? Any thoughts on the Kalama Sutta or that message, or Bhikkhu Bodhi's interpretation? Yes?
You know, one thing that surprises me, and this isn't the only sutta that he goes into, it's called a Saint Bet in Madhya Nikaya 60, you know, and it's the exact same thing, you know, if you practice this way, you'll have a good lifetime this lifetime, and if there's another lifetime, and if there's karma, you'll benefit that way. What's confusing to me, though, is from my reading, everybody at that time believed in karma.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't something, it was debated about exactly what karma is and the results of karma, but the belief was there, and so I'm kind of confused why in both of these he was mentioned, and I'm sure there's other sutras where he does the same thing, if you don't believe in it, so it's just a statement, you know, something that has confused me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And are the practices in Majjhima Nikaya 60 the same as in the sutta?
Almost the same.
The precepts and the Brahmaviharas? Yeah. And what audience was he addressing there?
In that one, he was actually speaking more to an individual.
Oh, okay.
But it was, the bottom line was the same as the first part of the Kalama Sutra.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, one of those weird things, I guess, in the
Pali
canon that they don't get.
Right. Good point.
Whatever.
Could be he was addressing us. Yes.
Well, I think that because he starts out in the Kalama Sutta with the dilemma of the Kalamas, which is that they get all these teachers saying all these different things, so while it's true that everybody believed that, there were still a lot of variations and people were coming through, and there were probably some who said, oh, this isn't true. Or, you know, and there's a whole other, I don't remember which sutta it is, where the Buddha refuses to engage on is there an afterlife, uh-huh, and is there this and is there that. So there were definitely variations in orthodoxy there and,
right,
and the belief system and what people were asked to accept. And
right,
I think that may be, you know, a corollary kind of this one, that there, even though, yes, if you should believe this, but, and most people did, there,
right,
was some variation among teachers.
Right, and remembering in one of those where he refuses to answer, he said, well, they asked him afterwards, right? His monks asked him afterwards, well, why didn't you answer that guy? And he says, well, if I had answered this way, it would have been supporting nihilism, that, you know, there is nothing after death. Or if I had answered this way, you know, and he kind of lays it out. So there were these other schools other than the strict, you know, Brahmanic practitioners that did believe in karma and rebirth. I suppose there are other philosophical schools running around India at that time that maybe didn't believe it. So,
in the beginning, you talked about the fact that faith wasn't necessary to understand or be on the path, and that it wasn't necessary to believe or adopt a belief system. But I'm wondering, you know, at what is the, you know, at some point, is there is there some efficacy to faith? I mean, you alluded,
mm-hmm,
to the fact,
yeah,
that,
yeah,
that there'll come a point where you may need to I don't know, make that leap, you know,
right, yeah, yeah,
where, you know, where it's not something you can understand by any of your sensory or logical faculties or anything. What is that point?
Yeah.
Where, you know, where does that begin? Or,
mm-hmm,
how does it fit in?
Well, that's a really great question. Maybe I'll ponder that between now and my next talk, because the first of the five spiritual faculties is faith. Okay. So the way that's traditionally taught is that at the beginning of practice, we're kind of going on a blind faith. We may see somebody that kind of inspires us, and we think, oh, well, I'd like to have the characteristics that that person has. Maybe I'll follow that path. But it's not verified in our own experience. And then the next stage is actually verified faith, where we start to have these experiences where we start practicing, and then actually we'll have some insight, or we'll have some kind of feedback, maybe from others, or changes in our behavior that actually verify that blind faith that we had before. And then the final is embodied, where it actually becomes kind of the default setting, where skillful actions just kind of come naturally because we've embodied all of the teachings rather than have to think about them intellectually. And at some point in that progression, I'm not exactly sure where that would happen, but probably at the third stage, we may begin to have an aspiration for liberation of the mind, to actually be completely free of suffering. Now, at that point, we are setting an aspiration for our practice in something that is beyond our own experience. We actually don't know, except with these little brief moments of momentary nibbana or daily nibbana, these little brief moments of freedom, but we actually don't know what it would be like to live a life completely free of greed, hatred, and delusion. But we're taking on a sort of, in a way, it's a leap of faith that if we continue on this path, eventually we'll be free from suffering. And so to me, that's the clearest point. There may be intermediate points in between, but to me, that's the clearest point where we actually take on an aspiration for something that is beyond our own experience. So in a way, it's a leap of faith. It's accepting that something is possible, partly because other people have told us that, but also partly because we've just experienced tiny little brief tastes of the flavor of what that might be like. Mm-hmm. I remember one experience where, and I've told this one in here before, so stop me if you've heard it too many times, but I went on retreat with my teacher Steve Armstrong and Kamala Masters in Maui at their place, at a YMCA facility right on the ocean. And had a great retreat, and my daughter likes coffee-covered macadamia nuts. So I walked in the gift shop at the Maui airport looking for coffee-covered macadamia nuts. Well, you know, as soon as I walked in, I got the whole spiel, you know, about, oh, well, we got this gift pack and this, that, and the other thing like that. And I had never before experienced having these, you know, delicious macadamia nuts and all the other delicious stuff they had in this airport and beautiful stuff with such dispassion, to be able to actually look at them, to hear the spiel, recognize it was a spiel, but not without any criticism of the spieler, you know. Uh-huh. just hearing it and recognizing, oh, that's a sales pitch, but that it wasn't moving me at all. You know, I wasn't kind of getting hooked by it at all. And they didn't have them. They had many other wonderful flavors, but oh, well, no, thank you. She liked this other flavor. And I was able to just say no very calmly and kind of walk out of that shop. And for that brief instant, I actually didn't have craving and recognized that I didn't have craving. So there was a brief moment, you know, and as soon as I got to the Honolulu airport, the craving was back. But, you know, just for that one moment, to actually experience a lack of that tug, that tie, that pull, that tanha, that grasping, clinging, kind of gave me faith that, well, maybe someday I could feel that way about more important things than Kona coffee-colored, you know, macadamia nuts. So, at this point in the practice, that's about as well as I can explain it. Please.
I'm trying to find where can I go get some methadone.
Next time I go over there, I'll bring you some.
Now, I love this practice because it goes to the heart of my experience, suffering and the end of suffering. And certainly through the practice and the experience, I've come to a point where I do have belief and I do have faith. So the experience precedes the belief and the faith.
Right.
And I came into the practice having a belief and a faith in a monotheistic God and the whole history that came with it, which every time I think about it, it frets me. That is the whole story of the monotheistic God and the people. It's very distressing. Probably adds more suffering. But I also realize that I'm not now trying to end suffering because it seems impossible. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to get tangled into something that's impossible. Mm-hmm. But what I do have in the practice in the Buddha nature is that the awareness creates a condition, a state of being where when there is suffering, it is not the same kind of suffering that I had in ignorance. And maybe I go to that moment where that suffering no longer is overbearing and it doesn't seem to be permanent. And so that awareness, and back to that word acceptance, mm-hmm. It has brought me to a place where I like this practice.
Thank you.
I guess, Raphael, I'm a little confused. That's not unusual for me. With the practice, I find myself in many ways understanding so much. This business of suffering. At one point, you think that's the whole. That's the value, that's the end of the practice from what I read and the way I interpret it. That, you know, you're doing practice to end suffering. Am I off track? Is that...
No, that's right.
So, Raphael, if you say, I don't want to end suffering, what do you say? I thought I heard you say, I, at this point, do not want to end suffering.
I've reached a place in the practice where I'm not reaching to end suffering. It's certainly good to not want or not to have suffering. It's very noble and it's good, but also realize that suffering is part of what I am. And so if all I did was sit to try to end suffering, then I may not get up from the sit and my legs start hurting after a while.
Oh. Yeah.
Um, just adding to what Raphael's saying here, the first way that I started to feel like the practice was actually working a little bit was that the intensity and the duration of my unskillful behaviors was going down.
Yeah.
So it didn't mean I wasn't, doesn't mean that I am still not engaging in unskillful behaviors. And if I'm doing that, I'm causing suffering for myself and others, right? So, I mean, the first noble truth is that there is suffering. But so if we set a goal, and we're going to get into some, if I get too semantic-y here, kick me. But if we set a goal of ending all suffering in the world, you know, that's going to be a pretty thick brick wall that we're hitting our head against. But if our aspiration is to reduce suffering as much as we can in this lifetime for ourselves and all those around us, that's a worthy aspiration. You know, maybe at some point setting it as a goal that, boy, if I don't eliminate all the suffering in my life and in the for all beings in this lifetime, I failed as a human being, that's kind of a big burden to take on. And, you know, although we don't take the bodhisattva vows in this particular tradition, I think it's useful to listen to the debate around that in the Mahayana tradition where they say suffering is endless, I vow to end it. You know, I mean, that's a bold, it's a bold statement. It's an aspiration. It's not a goal that any realistic person could expect to accomplish. It's the nature of this world to have suffering in it. And it's the nature of our lives to have suffering in it.
I certainly can understand that. I guess I'd more like say, you know, for me personally, being I still consider myself a beginner, a reduction in suffering, no matter how you define it, psychic, physically, emotionally,
yeah.
I just want to work toward a reduction. I can never get to the point where I think, you know, I'd like to do that, you know, daily. You know, there's so many things I'm attached to.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, I have to think about my attachments. Like, wow, do I really want to do this? So, I mean, it's the challenge. That's why I like to practice. I mean, you get in what you get out what you put in. So I think for me, there's at this point in my life, at this stage, I think I'll be suffering. It's just I want to suffer in my own way. And that doesn't make sense. This whole idea of suffering, you know, I'm sort of really suffering and attachments and accepting, you know, I deal with all of these concepts and they just sort of go in circles for me. You know, I got to accept equanimity, I got to accept things as they are. I have to work through that in terms of attachments.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great practice. I just don't seem to be making much progress with it.
Well, reduction in suffering sounds like progress to me.
I say that. I do think I'm making progress. It's just not at the rate I'd like to move, you know.
You know, it's all out of our control.
No, I don't think, for me, I think it's, maybe that's my problem. I think it is within my control.
Well, the external suffering that's around you, the conditions that are causing your suffering are out of your control. Now, your response to it
okay.
is within your control. But the fact that unpleasant things are going to be coming our way every day, that's not beyond, that's out of our control. We can't control that. We can't control the outside environment. Can't control the political environment. Can't control natural disasters. Absolutely.
That's the whole.
That's right.
That's the purpose of the practice.
That's right. Yeah. In fact, I heard a teacher get to your reduction of suffering point. I heard a teacher recently talk about this what we're talking about here, but this reduction versus total elimination of suffering. So the story of the second arrow. Right, the first arrow is the pain. The second is the suffering that we add to it in our own mind with all our proliferation or adding on or guilt or whatever it might be, right? So this teacher said, it's progress when you're only adding the second arrow. You're not adding the third, the fourth, the fifth, the sixth, the seventh, the eighth, the ninth, and the tenth.
Oh, yeah.
Right? So you haven't ended suffering, but you've reduced it, because, you know, with awareness, point here, with awareness, you're noticing at some point in that cycle of reactivity that's causing the ninth and the tenth arrow, you're noticing what's going on, and you're saying, hey, this is not how I want to live.
Let me say
please.
This. Before the practice, a lot of suffering was state, a lot of pain, a lot of hurting, past, present. And with the practice today, there's a lot of sadness. I cry a lot, not only for myself, but for what I see, what I notice around me. And it always used to be, don't cry. You shouldn't cry. Especially a man,
right.
Don't cry. And now, with the practice, I cry a lot. And in crying, in that sadness, certainly in my life, there is an end to the hurting and the pain that I was causing. And I do want to put my foot forward and my hand outstretched to try to alleviate or to end any suffering that I'm able to have a hands on. So that's always going to be a part of this practice for me. And so I do feel that in some way the practice has not only brought awareness into my life, but it has altered, it has changed my life in such a way that I'm able to feel a certain way that I was not able to before. If that ends suffering, well, that would be good.
Could you speak up just a bit?
Suffering is the first truth task, whatever you want to call it, but the second one says, and there's a cause for it, and that's craving or clinging, and that cessation is the way to end suffering. And I think that that's, you know, for me, that's a challenge, is to see clinging and to see craving. And I'm not quite there yet with the cessation, but I can see that when that happens, and those are the micro times, there is liberation when one can let go. That's the acceptance for me, the piece that's called acceptance. That's the letting go of the holding on to whatever it is. So it really is a multi-step process. The suffering in the world, all those things that are named in the first truth, those are
aspects of our life that that are going to go on, whether we're here or not.
Mm-hmm.
But it's how we face them, react to them.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't here. I didn't read this. I wasn't here for the first one. But isn't it sort of the essential aspect of it is that you were speaking about coming to a place that wasn't necessarily a complete elimination of all suffering. It was a place of happiness, of balance, of these qualities. I mean, if we look at the seven factors of enlightenment, just to cultivate two of them and cultivate them well is going to probably reduce some suffering. And then, because there's so many of these qualities that are true to our nature as well as our greed, hatred, and delusion, they're true for us and they can be practiced. And so this sutta is talking about practicing the Brahma Viharas. I do see an absolute relationship between the practice of these absolutely elegant, beautiful qualities that the Buddha in his awareness of the truth of what it was to be a human being, that's true for us. These are true for us. You know, we have these opportunities, and that's why I come to this because there's just great practices. You know, you just practice them, and it's not easy, man. You know, because the world is just. Sometimes it just like doesn't even make sense because our world sometimes when you drive and people are so mean and they're driving or they're so thoughtless and they're so self-centered, you know, it can be very discouraging so much of the time.
Well, thank you, everyone. Let's close with a brief sharing of the merit and metta. Just recognizing that indeed this world is filled with beings that are subjected to suffering on all levels, psychic, physical, social, that in one way it is the nature of the world and in another it's really contrary to our nature to be expressing the kind of selfishness and greed that we see so much around us. So to the extent that gathering together like this, meditating together, having discussions of the teachings together, to the extent that those help bring some sort of clarity to our minds and to generate some kind of positive energy in our lives, may we dedicate even the slightest benefit that we may have gained tonight to reducing the suffering in our lives and in the lives of all those around us, whether we know that we're impacting them or not. May all beings be safe and protected, peaceful and happy, healthy and strong. May all beings have some true sense of ease, and may all beings be free of suffering in some real way in this very life. Thank you for your practice.